Welcome to Orphaned Entertainment, the podcast dedicated to public domain and abandoned media. I'm your host, Christopher, and with me is one very independent woman. It's Lydia.
I should have my own theme song.
It does sound like that's an intro to a sitcom or something like that.
It does, yeah. And we'll probably get around to theme songs in a little bit here.
Well, before we go any further, thanks everyone. I want to thank everyone for tuning into this month's episode. Orphan Entertainment is available wherever you get your podcasts and wherever you choose to listen. If you have the option to do so, please rate and review the show. That helps get the show in front of more eyes and hopefully into more ears. Another great way to help is just by sharing the episode you're listening to on whatever social media platform you use. You can follow the link in the show notes to all our social media sites, as well as our YouTube channel, where you can watch many of the films we've covered here on the podcast. If you would like to email us with any comments, suggestions, or feedback on this or any episode, please type or record a message and send it to orphanedentertainment@gmail.com. With that, we'll listen to an Ellery Queen one-minute mystery and a promo for another podcast. And when we return, we will travel to New York to meet Millie.
Ellery Queen's Minute Mysteries. This is Ellery Queen with a case I call the Telltale Desk. A death was reported at a big midtown office building one morning. The only suspect was a man named Dwight, who was an associate of the dead man. Dwight said, "The man came storming into my office while I was hanging my coat, lunged for the top right-hand drawer of my desk, and pulled out my personal revolver. In the struggle, the gun went off. I asked Dwight if he was in the habit of locking his desk, and he said he only locked the middle drawer. "Then you're lying," I said. "In a moment, I'll explain why."
Greetings. Welcome to Film Gazers, a podcast focusing on the science fiction, horror, fantasy, trinity, and 20th century entertainment. I'm Steph.
I'm Jess. We're cousins slash besties. Join us as we reminisce, discuss, and review films from our childhood.
Follow on Instagram at FilmGazers and listen to the show wherever you like to get your podcasts.
Later, taters!
In the case of the Telltale Desk, most desk drawers are automatically locked by the middle drawer alone. Dwight said the dead man lunged for the right-hand drawer, which would have been locked. An oversight, but a big one. Listen again to Ellery Queen's Minute Mysteries.
Millie from 1931 is a pre-code drama directed by John Francis Dillon. The screenplay was written by Charles Kenyon and Ralph Morgan, and that was based on a novel of the same name written by Donald Clark. Clark finished the novel in 1930, and it was originally shot to MGM, but they passed on it due to the racy content. The film was independently produced by Charles Rogers and distributed by RKO Pictures shortly after their acquisition of Pathé Studios. The film stars Helen Twelvetrees, Robert Ames, John Halliday, Joan Blondell, and with an appearance by Anita Louise. In the film, Millie Blake is a young woman who elopes with a well-to-do businessman, Jack Maitland, and moves to New York. 3 years later, Millie finds herself unhappy in her marriage. She's a young daughter who's well taken care of by hired help, and her and Jack live in luxury. An additional frustration, though, is Jack's frequent business trips that leaves her all alone. While Jack is away on one of these trips, Millie receives a call from an old friend from her hometown, Angie, who happens to be in New York. Angie, her roommate Helen, meet Millie at a fashionable club where they spot Jack dancing with and kissing another woman. Millie files for and receives a divorce. Several years later, Millie is an employee at a hotel convenience desk where she is constantly rebuffing the flirtations of just about every man that comes along. One such man is wealthy banker Jimmy Damier, who she passes on in favor of reporter Tommy Rock. She and Tommy begin a relationship, but Millie refuses to marry again. Flash forward another few years, and Millie is now the manager of the hotel concessions and very successful. Unfortunately, she discovers that Tommy is being unfaithful to her as well. Now completely turned off by the idea of any serious relationship, Millie floats from man to man, including at some point, Jimmy. Sometime after Jimmy and Millie end their relationship, Jimmy sets his sights on Millie's now 16-year-old daughter, Connie. Millie has to go to extremes to save her naive daughter from Jimmy's advances. Now, we spoke about Helen 12 Trees back in May of 2021 when we discussed The Painted Desert, so please go and check out that episode to hear more about her. We have no less than three Wampus girls in the picture. We have mentioned that numerous times, but to remind everyone, the Wampus, W-A-M-P-A-S, Baby Stars was a promotional campaign started by the Western Association of Motion Picture Advertisers. This was intended to showcase young starlets that they thought were up and coming in the industry. The campaign had a lot of misses, but also got it right in many cases, including Bessie Love, Evelyn Brent, Clara Bow, Joan Crawford, Faye Ray, to name a few. And in this film, we have Helen 12 Trees, Joan Blondell, and Anita Louise. I am not sure if we've seen Joan Blondell before, though her name seems awfully familiar.
I thought the same thing. And she's one of those names that you're like, I know I've heard of her, and you probably have seen her in something. But really, ironically, I think the thing people probably know her from are her late, like, I think she was known as an actor during this time, and that made her famous for later appearances in things like Grease, Fantasy Island, just, you know, it's late, you know, 70s specials and shows and things like that, where it was more, she was brought in because she had been a bigger name. And so we think of her as being a big name because she was big enough at the time to have bit parts in those movies and be featured as, in, you know, with special star Joan Blondell.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. Well, she was a daughter of a vaudeville family, and she got her start after winning a beauty contest before she set off for her acting career. She first appeared on stage with a stock company that often performed on Broadway. She was seen by Al Jolson in the show Penny Arcade alongside James Cagney. Jolson bought the rights to the play and then promptly sold it to Warner Brothers with the proviso that Blondell and Cagney be cast in the film version. The film was titled Sinner's Holiday and debuted in 1930. The film was a modest success, and Blondell was placed under contract with Warner Brothers. She was paired several more times with Cagney and 9 times with actress Glenda Farrell. And before the end of the decade, she would make nearly 50 films. She left Warner in 1939 and returned to Broadway briefly. Her subsequent films found her cast as supporting and character roles until 1945's Adventure, where she was top billed over Clark Gable.
Oh, wow.
And she spent the rest of her career bouncing between film and stage and finding lots of work on television until her death in 1979. A couple films that she appeared in shortly before her passing, as Lydia mentioned, 1978's Grease, and the remake of The Champ in 1979. She would appear in 2 more films after her death, The Glove and The Woman Inside. I also just want to point out that another actor we've seen before, John Halliday, we saw him in the excellent film Hotel for Women, where he once again was an older man vying for a much younger woman.
Just like in the Philadelphia Story, which he's probably best known for.
Yeah, so check out that episode from May of 2023 in regards to Hotel for Women. Yeah, that he definitely seems to have his niche, or his little niche, doesn't he?
He does, and I think it's interesting to see him in this movie because it's, of course, much earlier than the Philadelphia Story. I suppose it's only 9 years. It feels so much earlier.
Well, I think it's about 10 years or almost 10 years earlier from Hotel for Women, I think.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Yeah. This is a 1931. Hotel for Women is 1939. So
okay, eight
we're
years.
About
All right.
8-9 years there. But he, it's funny, like he looks the exactly the same. but in this movie, it's a little bit of a, it's a little different for him because in like in every other role that I can think of, he plays like a really decent guy. And in this one, he's seducing a 16-year-old, which is yucky.
Yeah, quite yucky. I don't think there's any way. I mean, in Hotel for Women, I think you could think it a little yucky only because we found out the actual age of the actress.
Yes, but she's not supposed to be that age in the movie.
No, she's playing older, yeah. But it's still, when you see him trying to kiss on her, you're like, oh, she's, wow.
but she didn't look so young. In this case, Anita Louise looks 16.
Oh, yeah, easily.
Yeah. So, and she, I guess at the time of filming, she would have been about 16. She was born in 1915. This is 1931. So, yeah. So she really, wow, would have actually, he would have actually really been kissing a 16-year-old girl. Wow. Yes. Well, the things we figure out. Hooray for math, you know. Yeah. The teacher said we'd use it.
You mentioned something about he doesn't look any different in this than he does in like Hotel for Women or what was the other Philadelphia Story you said was another one?
Yeah, the Philadelphia Story.
That was actually something I had a little bit of an issue with just within this film. It takes place over the course of about 16 years. It makes no effort to make anybody look younger or older. It's like a weird alternate universe where it's 1931 the entire time.
I think except for Millie, I think they really put a lot of effort into making her look very young at the beginning and very worn down. I think they tried to age her, but it wasn't the kind of aging that we're used to where they add wrinkles.
No, I think they, like, when she's supposed to be a young, you know, teen or young 20-something herself at the beginning of the film, they just... Okay, put a hat and smile a lot. It was pretty much
and use the big eyes and the innocent voice. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, that was about as close as you get to younging her down.
Mm-hmm. It's funny. There isn't a very large main cast, but it feels like there is a very large cast. And more to the point, there are large groups of people. So, let's see. Not, what's his name? Is it Tommy?
Tommy the reporter?
Yeah. Yes, Tommy has a group of friends, and every time all of his friends are together, I couldn't tell which one was his or which one was him. I had no idea. Mm-hmm. You know, and then Millie's hanging around with her two friends who are both blonde, and like, yes, you can tell who they are because they have different faces, but there keeps being these groups of people running around together, and it's kind of like, wait, which one is that? Which one is that? And I think part of that's the film quality, and part of it is what you're talking about, where there's not a whole lot of effort put into maybe making characters distinct from one scene to the next or from one age to the next. And so the whole time, anytime any guy came onto the scene that wasn't Jimmy, I always thought it was Tommy. No matter who it was. And then it would end up not being Tommy. So, that's a thing.
And it's something I don't know if you noticed. I don't feel like they did anything with the clothes, with the costumes either.
No.
Everyone was pretty much wearing whatever they would be wearing at the end of the film. They wore the same style of clothing at the beginning of the film.
That's true. And especially the men. I think they didn't put any... This is one of those tricky times when, with the costuming, especially through the 1920s and 30s, unless they're putting them into some kind of antebellum giant hoop skirt, they really don't try very hard in most movies to go with any kind of period, you know, detail or changes. So this is a movie in 1931. We don't know when it's supposed to start out. We don't know if it's supposed to be starting out in 1931, and then we're supposed to be 17 years in the future. It's supposed to be 1947, or we don't know if the end of the movie is supposed to be 1931, in which case everybody should be 17 years earlier wearing, oh gosh, that would have been 1912, which would have been a completely different set of clothing. We're talking, you know, we're still talking floor length skirts and corsets at this point in 19, whatever the math was that I just said. So yeah, they definitely don't put any effort into showing the progression of time on it. I do think they tried with her face too. Nobody else though. I think for her, they were trying to show the aging, especially at the end. You see that her, when she's very young, she's got that very fresh, clean face. Then as she becomes kind of more of a wanton woman, they go very heavy on the makeup, very stylized on her hair. And then when she's supposed to be this dejected, sad, tragic person at the end, they take away a lot of the makeup and try and give her like some aging and some, they try to shadow under her eyes, things like that to show that she's worn down and she's tired. I think they put a lot of effort into that. And honestly, for the time, I think they did a very good job, but they focused all of their effort on her and not on anybody else.
I think it would have been nice if there was just some other element in the film beyond the occasional title card that sort of gets some little cryptic, and as the years pass, you know, kind of thing.
8 years later.
Yeah, some element that would show the passage of time. It would have been nice if we could have seen her daughter Connie age. We see her as like a little three-year-old at the beginning of the film. I'm guessing two or three. You know, she can stand up, so she's a toddler. Mm-hmm. Why couldn't have she been part of the story more, that so you could actually, oh, this is her now as oh, I can't believe she's 8 now. Oh, I can't believe she's 12 now. That sort of thing.
Yeah.
She would have been a really great time passage tool.
Yeah, absolutely. They leave some gaps in there to do with that, where when Millie and her first husband, Jack, when she gets a divorce from him, which happens off screen, her friends say, oh, how can you bear to give up your daughter without getting some compensation for it? And she says, well, I want her to have a great life. It doesn't seem right to take her away from all of that. But then at the end of the movie, her daughter knows who she is, but we never see her with her daughter ever again. We literally have one scene at the beginning.
Yeah, she mentions at that point when she's talking with her friends, she's like, well, you know, I know she's being taken care of, and I see her every Sunday.
She does say Sundays.
Yeah, so she is in her daughter's life.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like one of these things like, oh, she doesn't know who I am or anything.
Don't see any of that. So
no, we do not.
It just disappears.
It's just very much, and as integral as her daughter ends up being at the end of the film,
it would have been nice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it definitely feels like a little out of left field to suddenly reintroduce her into the movie.
Yeah, definitely. Yes. I was going to start explaining more, but yeah, yes sums up perfectly what I was going to say.
And some of this may be a budgetary constraint, being that it was kind of independently produced. It didn't have a major studio. Even when it was distributed through one of the smaller studios. At least at the beginning, it was a Pathé Pictures, and then RKO acquired Pathé, and they're the ones that released the film.
Mm-hmm.
So this is maybe something where it was just, when it came to adapting the novel, that kind of stuff may have been left out. Just for budgetary reasons. We don't have the time, we don't have the money for the cast, sort of thing.
So we're running up against yet another movie where we go, oh yeah, this was based on a book. Would have been nice to have read the book. Dang it.
Yes. And I think there is definitely, this is a movie where you see the shortcomings of a small budget.
Mm.
The sets are very minimal.
Mm-hmm.
You see just, there's not a lot of creative camera work within the sets. When we see the stuff, you're like, oh, welcome to the hotel. This is the lobby. You won't go beyond this this counter.
There is the one scene where she and Tommy go to Coney Island.
Yeah.
And they work very, very hard to make you believe that they're at Coney Island. And it's completely unconvincing, but they're trying so hard.
They are. It's really sweet. I love the when they're supposedly on the roller coaster. And it's done with, like, you know, an overlay where they're you see the couple and then you see, like, stock footage of the roller coaster.
Yeah.
And they're just sitting next to each other going, oh, it's so much fun.
We're so high up. Yeah. They, you know, of course, they didn't have the kind of, oh, gosh, all the kind of gadgets that we have now where you can actually clip a camera onto the front of a roller coaster. But so I kind of actually, and that was exactly what I was thinking of. They really didn't have a lot of options. They could have done, you know, a roller coaster cart with a projection on the in the background, which is what you would typically expect to see. So it's a little bit interesting / odd that they chose to do that overlay instead of literally anything more convincing.
And I want to know where that guy got his hat, because that hat fits really well to not fly off on a roller coaster.
It's the same stuff the gymnasts use under their leotards to keep them from riding up.
Yeah,
you just spray it and stick it on.
Yes. So somehow I was just going to say it's the grease in his hair. I'm thinking, no, that would probably make it...
make it slipperier. It's exactly the shape of his head. He never takes it off. His whole head is that shape. It's really just a hat brim.
Yeah. But yes, definitely the Coney Island adventure was also another thing that I was going to point out is this being showing the budget constraints that the film had.
It's funny. I didn't really think about it. I just kind of went with, well, it's a 1931 movie and they didn't maybe really have a great option for how to, you know, show them having fun in an amusement park. But with you saying that, you're 100% right. They had tons of options.
You could have had them at the amusement park. you could have seen them like go and get on the roller coaster or be in line or walking down the Broadway or something of the park. I mean, they didn't even do that. This was strictly studio-bound filming.
And it is funny, too, because usually you'd expect to see him, you know, maybe ride one ride and then hang out at a bench and talk or something like that. And instead, it's like 5, 6, 7 rides that they're faking and not with any valuable dialogue over it. Just, oh, we're so high, or, oh, look at all the tiny people. It is interesting. So, yeah, interesting choice there, director. Very interesting. Very. Or editor, whomever it was that made that decision.
I found so much of the film relied on things that happened off screen or in a very abbreviated manner.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, I think it just kind of put me off a little bit.
Well, so this movie, I felt when I was watching it, like it was incredibly long, like a 2 or 3 hour movie. It's only, what, an hour and 25 minutes? Something like that, maybe even less than that. Part of it is that you keep having entire story arcs happen in the span of 5 or 10 minutes. And so she gets married. She goes to the hotel. You have this whole kind of comedic scene. She breaks down on the phone to her mother and says, I'm married. That's the end of a sitcom right there. Or that's the end of a rom-com, right? She's just crying because she just doesn't know how to, you know, manage it. And then you have the scene with her, you know, her husband and he's not ever around and they have their fight and then she goes out to hang with friends and then she sees him and then she confronts him and then she decides to get a divorce. That's a whole nother movie on its own, right? I mean, that's the first half of Under the Tuscan Sun, I think.
Yeah. No, this entire film is made out of little vignettes of other movies, it feels like. Even when her friends are introduced.
Yes.
You suddenly, you know, she has this fight with her husband and then she has this conversation with her mother-in-law and then the phone rings and suddenly it's these people we've never seen before. We don't know anything about and they're just two women and another really stern looking apparently landlady.
Two women. Okay. And maybe this is just where my mind is. Two women in a bed and one of them is smoking a cigarette.
In their nightgowns.
So I'm the last person to think anything strange of that. But in this particular instance, my mind immediately went to, wow, this looks very intimate. So I don't, and then through the whole, this is like a total derailment of the whole thing that we want to talk about here. But then for the rest of the movie, these two women are together. They're running around. They're playing the field. They're always together. And then at the end, one of them decides, and this isn't the end, I don't think I'm spilling anything too big here. One of them decides to get married, and the other one's irritated about it. It just is a little bit.
I'm glad to hear you say that, because I wasn't sure if it was just me in the 21st century looking at that and getting that kind of vibe incorrectly.
Yeah.
Or am I, are we supposed to think that? That, you know, in this film?
Yeah. And you never see them with any other men. Like, they always are showing up together. They just came back from Saratoga and they both have furs, right? They just came from somewhere and, oh, they just met up together and they're going to have drinks. She's over at their house and, or they're at her house and they're talking about the party they're going to have, but there never are any men around. And for women whose entire purpose is to, quote, find opportunities, unquote, I believe is the term that she uses. That's a little bit of a sideline, just, you know, but I couldn't help looking, first of all, at the scene and then at everything that happens afterwards and just questioning.
Yes.
It's just, I feel like the question should be asked. I don't think we can answer it.
No, unfortunately not. Now, one of the women is Joan Blondell, and she's the one who, I mean, if you could call any of the lines in this film kind of like the comic relief.
I think
that was definitely her.
Yes.
And she does talk a little bit, so it sounds like she's sort of at least somewhat man-hungry.
Well, for heaven's sake.
Hey, who's been gilding these lilies?
Hello, Millie.
Hello.
Hello,
Millie. Oh, don't you look grand?
We're just back from Saratoga. What a season we've had.
Oh, they're lovely. You know Mr. Rock, don't you?
I'm afraid so. Oh, we're lunching at Sherry's.
Yeah, what's going on there? A trade convention?
Soak your head. Would you like to come along, dear?
No, I'm going to Coney with Tommy.
What a man.
I have my moments. Mm. I'll be back in a minute.
What in the world do you see in that egg?
Oh, he's a nice boy, and he doesn't try to pull me.
She goes out with men for the darndest reasons.
Oh, say, we saw Maitland in Saratoga, and of all the parties he threw. You know, Millie, every time I think of you turning down that Maitland dough, I get chilblains. Hmm.
When I'm through with a man, I'm through.
When I'm through with a man, I'm just beginning.
Let's go, huh?
All right. You don't mind if we run?
No, bring us up sometime, Millie, will you?
Sure, I will.
Don't let Millie eat too much.
No, I won't. Come on, dear.
Look at her, going to Coney with a reporter.
I don't know what it is, but that town you two came from leaves a terrible mark.
What kind of a mark?
Oh, shut up.
You like men for the strangest reasons.
Yeah. Yes. Okay, yeah. No, that's a fair point. I had forgotten that line. But, yeah, still raising my eyebrows a little bit there.
Yeah, no, very much. I'm glad I wasn't the only one.
Yeah, and I...
But that entire scene, you're talking about, you think this conversation was derailing what we're talking about, but I'm thinking, that's what this film does,
okay.
I think, from scene to scene, is it suddenly derails whatever was just going on.
Yeah, that it is. You're exactly right about it being just a series of vignettes, and it feels like you keep having an end to the story, and then it... Oh, look, nope, there's another chapter. And so it feels like you're just getting a story after a story after a story. So, I understand that they're building the case for the end of this movie. They're saying she started off this innocent, sweet person, and by the end of the movie, she has been through all of this, and she's chosen, and I'm actually frankly surprised that they chose to show a character who actively makes the statement to a boyfriend, I don't want to marry you because our love should stand the test of our relationship should stand that test with love. We shouldn't need to get married to be able to prove that we are right together, which for 1931 is mind blowing.
And then to take the step to show them apparently living together, unmarried.
Well, they show her their house for sure when she goes and wrecks it. Mm-hmm. They definitely are living together. I'm partly amazed that they show it at all. And I mean, are we technically in the Hays Code at this point, or are we still just before it?
We're just before it.
Okay, good. Okay, that makes sense. I was just about to say, I don't think that they can end this movie the way they do, but this is probably one of the last movies that they can end this the way that they do. And I won't get too into details on it, but definitely there are some characters that should have a very, very unhappy ending that don't have a very, very unhappy ending under the Hays Code. So, or should under the Hays Code have it. So it's interesting, but it definitely kind of drags on. And when it got to where it said something about another 8 years passes, I was like, really? Oh my goodness, really? And now what's gonna happen? And you know, if you start out this, let's do a little bit math again. Sorry, this is now the math podcast. And let's pretend for a moment that she's 20. We'll say when she gets married, she's still only 37 at the end of this movie. So mm-hmm. she wouldn't necessarily, you know, be the haggard, old, wrinkly lady. But they try to show her emotional changes through her appearance. But you are right. They don't do that with anybody else. So you see a little bit of a change from scene to scene. So by the time that we get to where her daughter, who we find out at the end of the movie, is named Connie. I didn't catch that at the beginning. Did you?
No, okay. I don't know that she says her name.
I don't know that she does either. By the time that Connie is 16, now Millie is wearing black, kind of somber clothes, not doing her makeup real pretty, not doing her hair real pretty. So they're trying to make it. And then the thing I think that they do to make her seem the most different is she has kind of a drunken swagger when she comes into the restaurant, when she sees Jimmy again for the first time after, several years, I guess. And she has this kind of, I can't think of quite the right term for it, kind of a loose woman walk that she doesn't have until then. Mm-hmm. And it was just had flashbacks to Wild Child with Emma Roberts, where they're talking about the tilt of her hips. And I was thinking, I guess the director thought that if that a loose woman walks a certain way. So that's interesting. But yeah, it felt really long both times I watched it. Not really bad, just really long, which yeah. I guess you could translate to could have been a little bit more fun.
I don't know. They could have cut out maybe, I don't know what they could have cut out. I don't know how they could have truncated it to bring it down. I mean, at an hour and a half is, to me, seems a little long for the time period too.
A little, yeah. That's the thing that's so strange is that it feels like it drags. Mm-hmm. And it's not a 2-hour movie. But I think, again, because they cram so much into it. And also, you see, it's almost like you're seeing a different character. And I think they did this on purpose. I think they were trying to show the progression of her attitude changing. But she feels like a very different character from one section of scenes to the next section of scenes. Of course, at the beginning, she's very innocent, you know. And then she moves on to being, I think, still innocent, but maybe disillusioned, and then becoming extremely independent. She's just straight up a Beyonce song at one point. And then she becomes, I guess, romantic, and then just very, I'm just going to say slutty, just very, very slutty. And I appreciate, like, she doesn't, I don't think they take a total deviation from the character. You still feel like she has a whole lot of heart and soul to her, but she still feels like a very different character at each point. And mm-hmm. so it's almost disruptive. It's the progression makes sense, but I don't think you get a chance to really invest in her because she's so busy changing.
Yeah, no, exactly. So you don't really get any feeling of, oh, look how far she's fallen. You know, you don't care because we haven't spent enough time with her at any point earlier on mm-hmm. that it feels a little like false, you know, at the end.
I think I kept thinking, wow, what an interesting choice to make at this stage in her life. Mm-hmm. Not like, oh, yeah, that's how I'd feel. More like, oh, well, that's an interesting choice. Okay.
And I want to put a little bit finer point. You said that she kind of turns into a slutty woman. that isn't any kind of commentary on, you know, it doesn't mean that a woman can't be free with her sexuality and everything. It's pretty much stated in this film that she is literally I mean, that is how she is kind of portrayed in the film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know. Yes, that's not me making a judgment. That's right. Her saying, nope, I'm going to have as many men over as I want to, and no man can say anything about it. Which is, I guess you can term that sexual freedom, but she's not doing it out of a point of empowerment. She's mm-hmm. doing it from a standpoint of woundedness. And so it doesn't feel like a sexual revolution. It feels like a sexual slump.
Yeah, the movie certainly never comes out and says it, but Jimmy has some code for it and some of the way he talks to other people mm-hmm. Throughout the film in a very gentlemanly way.
I like that you use that term because I was just thinking, yeah, he's kind of a jerk.
He is, absolutely.
You can tell he's enamored of her. And then there's the scene where he's talking to his friend. I think this is what you're thinking of, where he is talking around it. He doesn't just come out and say, man, that's the loosest woman this side of the Hudson or anything mm-hmm. like that. But he does say, you know, oh, it's too bad. You should have known her before. And, you know, oh, yeah, I got tired of her deciding when I could come over, which is... Not, I mean, you ain't wrong, bro, but at the same time, it's kind of like, if that's what actually upset you about your relationship with her, maybe time to reevaluate your priorities.
Well, I think he got annoyed. He was trying to actually, I think, date her. He wanted a relationship with her.
He wanted to walk her home, that's for sure. But that, yeah, to me is a 1930s euphemism for not marrying her.
Oh, no, absolutely not. But I think it annoyed him that they obviously had some sort of relationship at some point, mm-hmm. but her attitude towards it was, well, why not? I don't care.
Yeah, I could take it or leave it.
Right. And I think that annoyed him. It wasn't as thrilling for him as he thought it might be.
Well, I can make a really unpopular comment right at this moment, but I'm going to bite my little tongue and not say, yeah, it's funny how insert type of person here finds it really offensive when insert type of person here doesn't need them around all the time. But I just did it too, but in a more generalized way. But yes. Yeah, it is interesting that their relationship is strange. I never quite felt from the beginning that he's really sincere with her. He always wants to walk her home. He doesn't necessarily want to get down on one knee. So,
well, and especially in the end when he's looking to bed her daughter, obviously there is a certain fixation he has with younger women.
Yes, that too. And then I also had the question of, is he doing this to get back at her? I think they have that the scene in church where he sees her daughter and, you know, and then later he says, you're the most beautiful girl I've ever seen. But through the whole thing, I still keep feeling like it's a revenge plot. I still kept feeling like he wanted to get his own for Millie not ever, you know, taking him seriously or needing him or whatever it was that he wanted.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just the story just, it went strange places and it didn't go places where you might have expected it to go.
Mm-hmm.
I think a storyline that you might have expected for this film would be him thinking, Millie wouldn't be like this if she had been with me.
Yeah.
I could have saved her from all this. He could have looked at her with some amount of pity, and I don't feel we ever got that from him at all.
Yeah, no. Yeah, I agree.
So, yeah, and then the men that wrong her just disappear after doing so. husband Jack, oh, I'm filing for divorce, and you're out of the film.
Yeah.
Boyfriend Tommy, you've cheated on me. I'm going to rip all the curtains and just trash our house. And you're out of the film.
Well, he shows up again, but in a very kind of, But what you just said about you expect the movie to go a certain direction, it doesn't. Even with Tommy, I felt like there was an opportunity for closure at the end that they do not take advantage of. I honestly expected that to be where it was going, was, hey, Tommy was going to show up, save the day, and that isn't exactly what happens. Oh, it happens under a certain argument, but not the way you expect it to happen, for sure.
And maybe this is because it's pre-code, and so they were, I guess, freer to go different routes. I mean, in the end, when Tommy comes home and finds everything trashed, he actually sits there and kind of, you know, cries in his hands.
Yeah.
So you could have easily seen him show up as a, I'm sorry, I was wrong, I want to do better.
Doesn't happen. Well, he does try to call her.
Hello? Tommy.
Say, I just want to wish you a Merry Christmas. You remember the last one we had together?
I haven't been giving it much thought, but thanks for the good wishes.
Oh, say, Millie, I'm feeling kind of low. Couldn't I drop over for a little while?
No, I'm sorry, Tommy. I'm busy. But Merry Christmas and thanks for calling up. Goodbye.
Oh, don't cry, Millie. You know what you need? A good drink.
Merry Christmas. Hey, what are you talking about? You got everything you want, haven't you?
Sure. Everything.
That's good.
Shall I answer that? No. That old Jimmy Damien. He's been calling up all night.
He probably lost his keys and wants to get in somewhere.
Well, he's not going to get in here tonight. You can only come here when I say so.
Hey, I know what's the matter with you. That Tommy Rock calling you up and sending you those flowers.
Sure. All the others have bottles.
Say, why don't you get him out of your mind? He's nothing but a good-looking tramp.
But, Helen, you don't understand. You've never really been in love.
Oh, no? Hey, listen, there was an actor in Toledo. Oh, I just cried my eyes out.
Oh, hell. I didn't mean to make you cry.
It's all right, Millie, I'm sorry.
Forget them. They're all alive.
Hey, the only thing I ever got out of love was the pain.
And then they're all tramps.
Oh, awful tramp. Skull.
Skull.
And it's you get the idea that he's trying really hard to reconnect with her, and she still won't allow it. So it's such an interesting movie. It's one of those movies where I won't say she's not an anti-hero. I was thinking a minute ago, this is what we would call a character-driven plot. This is a story where nothing happens unless a character has an emotional response to something and changes what they're doing. It's all very character-driven. There's no external impetus, no external impact at all on anything that happens in this movie. It's just people interacting with each other and sometimes making poor choices. But it almost seems like it's not just sometimes making poor choices. It's almost, this is, you know what this is? I just figured out what this is. This is the 1931 romance version of Game of Thrones. This is, this is the writer sitting down and going, so if you take all these people that could potentially have happy endings and nobody gets a happy ending, that's what this is. This is 1931 romance Game of Thrones.
So if this were color, we'd end with a red wedding.
I think we have Daenerys as the last person standing. And yeah, it is. It really feels like that. It feels like at every step, every person involved makes the worst choice they can. And then they were like, let's see what happens. So yeah, I think I've solved the mystery.
Yep. No, all I right. think you're, I think you're right. Yes. Sex is evil and no one hits a happy ending.
That's what it is. It's yeah. It, you know, it well, marriage will make you unhappy. Being a loose woman will make you unhappy. Basically just nobody can be happy. That's what it is.
No. Yeah. And I mean, not spoiling anything or whatever at the end, I don't know that anyone comes out happy in this film. I mean, the film stops, but I'm still thinking, where do you go from here? That's the.
I mean, I guess we could get into how we could interpret the end of this movie. We usually don't. We're usually very careful to stay away from the end and, you know, to avoid spoilers. I almost feel like this is a good candidate for to just have a little 5-minute session, say, okay, let's talk about what we think the end really means. What happened to these people? If this movie had gone on for another 5 minutes, what would we have seen? Because it does end very abruptly, and it ends in a way, in a good direction, kind of, maybe, a bit, but it also ends, like you said, so abruptly that I think it wants you to believe everything's wrapped up in a tidy, happy bow. So do we want to do that? Do we want to try and interpret?
Yeah, let's go ahead. Okay. This is going to be one of these instances where we're going to spoil the film and talk about the ending.
Official spoiler warning. If you haven't finished the movie, you want to finish the movie, go finish the movie. Pause the podcast now. Go finish the movie and then come back.
Heart on hopeless affairs. She's merely the redhead, but nobody cares.
Welcome to Act 17 of this film.
So Millie has shot Jimmy in front of her daughter, who was being molested by him. I mean, kissed, but on the way to being molested.
Yes,
it definitely
absolutely.
Was in that vein.
Oh, and no, yeah. She was not going to leave that cabin.
Innocent.
And exactly.
You're welcome. And so, you know, everybody knows she shot him. They have a big courtroom scene. But apparently they snuck the daughter out, so Connie wasn't there. They're trying to get the DA to cherche la femme. They're trying to find the other woman. And then all of a sudden, Connie shows up with Tommy and, you know, oh, mom, I'm going to testify. And suddenly it's okay for Millie to have shot Jimmy because it was to defend Connie's honor. Mm-hmm. And as soon as that decision is made, they walk out, they get in a car, and that's the end of the movie. Like, and they say something about Mrs. Maitland, who was Jack's mother, her husband's mother, having stuck by Connie and Millie the whole time. And so my interpretation is, let's start with what I expected to happen. What I expected to happen was Millie sees Tommy bring Connie to the courtroom and is like, oh, you came to save me. You love me. Okay, I'll give it a shot with you. Not what happened.
No.
What did you expect to happen?
Or maybe it does, and that's the next scene. You know, 8 years later.
Millie, will you marry me? We're turning 80 this year. Please, right. Honey, finally stick by me, you know?
Yeah.
That was...
I honestly, by the time we got to the end of this film, I had no idea what was going to happen because this film was so all over the map throughout the entire course of the film that it really just felt like, you know what, whatever. Whatever happens, that it makes as much sense as anything else in this movie. Sure. I Yeah. Other than what I was saying before, that you would might expect in a film of this kind, and like you were just said that, you know, you know, Tommy somehow, you know, redeems himself or something like that. Yeah, does he? Maybe. Does she see that? Maybe. Do they get to back together? Maybe. It's just, or not, you know. Or she says, well, I would go out with you, but I've already got a date with two other men that week.
Yeah, I mean, I got the feeling by the time that she's begging Jimmy to stop seeing, to stop hanging around Connie, that she's not really seeing. No, but I mean, literally the scene before that, she is hanging out with just some random guy. So right. I think you have to be right. She must still be hitting that. I don't know. You know, she's, it's so confusing. She seems like she's, by the time that she staggers into the restaurant, you know, doing the loose woman walk with that guy, you kind of get the feeling that maybe she has stopped working. Maybe now she is just relying on men for money, but they don't really outright say it. And she still wants to be in charge all the time. So what I expected to happen definitely didn't happen. So how I took the end of the movie was, okay, so the three women go and get in the car, and now you have Grandma, Mom, and Connie just living together somewhere and trying to make sure Connie doesn't have a horrible ruined life. Like,
go the way of her mom.
Yeah. Like, literally, like, okay, don't repeat. Do what I say, not what I do, basically. And that's kind of how I interpreted it. And I thought, well, I guess in a way she like rides off into the sunset, because obviously Grandma has a lot of money. She got a nice car and everything. And obviously Connie's doing very well, because she always was. So now maybe that's saying now Millie is too, because she's going to go live with them and they're all going to take care of each other.
Your guess is as good as mine.
Yeah, it's a very fried green tomatoes kind of ending.
Yeah, it's a little bizarre.
Yeah.
I was a little even bothered by the whole courtroom and the idea that the trial and how it ends, and even what it hinged on is, you know, where is this other woman that could defend you and everything?
They could have shown them hustling Connie out of the building.
I couldn't even figure out through most of the trial whether she was actually being accused. Was she on trial, or was she just a witness?
Yeah, no, I get what you're saying, because they didn't really state it very well. So a few things, right? They should have shown somebody getting Connie the heck out of that lodge. Okay. Mm-hmm. Anybody that's seen, by the way, anybody else there seen How to Marry a Millionaire? We all know what a lodge is now. So thank you very much, Betty Grable, for teaching us what a lodge is in How to Marry a Millionaire. If you haven't seen it, go see it. It's just a phenomenal movie. Lauren Bacall, Betty Grable, and Marilyn Monroe, by the way, in case you're wondering. And so I would have expected, after she shoots the guy, somebody has to show up and help her clean up this mess. Because obviously they got Connie out of the way before the police showed up, because the police hadn't known Connie was there. But why aren't we told that? Why aren't we shown that? This is the argument people have. Film is visual media. Show the story. Don't just tell people what happened after the fact. And that is just now coming out of my mouth and explaining what's so frustrating about this movie. This is a movie, but we get so much of being told what happened without being shown what happened that really it seems more like an audiobook.
Who even knew that Millie shot him in the first place? If they were somehow able to get Connie out of the lodge, why couldn't Millie and Connie leave together and it just be a big mystery about how Jimmy got shot?
Yeah, unless like she, like her daughter saw her shoot somebody. I suppose if you don't want to traumatize your child for life, shooting somebody and then taking responsibility for that is a way to get through that.
I suppose.
But we don't know. It's a question that they don't answer, which needs to be answered.
Well, and it's the whole, we don't know who the other woman was. And they don't know that Connie was there. Well, we do, and so does Jimmy's driver, who's the one that told Millie.
Who they were hiding, though. So maybe that's who showed up and helped her. Because he was supposed to come back in 2 hours. Again, things that could have been shown. So he was supposed to come back in 2 hours.
Was someone hiding him?
Yes, the reporters. Remember the big group of friends that Tommy has that I can't tell any of them apart? At the end, all of the reporters are together in a room and they're trying to convince the DA to look for the other woman. Apparently that's supposed to be a clever plot twist, but it just fell really flat. But yeah, they are, and then at some point he walks in, the driver does, but you don't know it's the driver. And I think they sort of explain it, but it isn't super clear. He's not wearing a driving cap, but for the first time in the movie, they actually give a wardrobe change, but it's not a helpful one. He does show up. They say, no, you have to stay hidden. We're setting it up. We're gonna play it this way. And he's the one that's upset, saying, well, it doesn't look like you've done it very well. From where I stand, it looks like this isn't going well at all. Millie's on the stand. It looks like they're gonna convict her. And so, yes, he does come back. But again, these are things that it's too confusing. They tried to make it clever, or they tried. It's probably, I think your initial statement of it being a budgetary thing is probably right. They probably went, oh crud, none of this makes sense. Quick, let's do a scene with all of the reporters trying to convince the DA to look for the woman, and then we'll have the driver walk in. And it just, I feel like I'm at the end of Clue. But what could have happened was this.
Right. Yeah, see, there you go. So if you literally miss a line in this film, you're completely lost. I completely missed that they were hiding the driver. Because I was wondering, well, there's no way that this court wouldn't have the driver on the stand, because he knows who Jimmy took to this lodge. Well, and
they do go to the point in the trial where he says, who called you in the middle of the night? She says, I don't know. And he's, you know, and then they, you know, they say, who was the other woman? I don't know. Didn't she turn to see her leave? No, I didn't. They ask her all these questions. And I guess the director maybe was relying heavily on her acting ability to draw you in. And I think, again, you know, we're watching this almost 100 years later. Wow. That sounded like a long time. We are watching this almost 100 years later. This film has been through some massive changes. And so during this time, maybe people just were better at paying attention than we are. Maybe they had less of this, you know, constant influx of fatigue, of, you know, media fatigue that we have.
Maybe.
But yeah, I think that there, if there were a screenplay to read along with, which actually I watch stuff with CCTV on, or with the CCTV, what am I trying to say? With the closed captions on. And so that's probably where I pick up a little bit more of it.
Oh,
of certain
very
things.
Smart. Yeah.
I have to. I'm getting to that age, guys. But I do watch.
And with some of the films, if you can find a copy that actually has the closed captioning, with some of the audio of some of the films we watched, that would be very helpful.
It is helpful. Absolutely.
I don't know why I never think of that.
Because you have perfect hearing. That's why. Mine's a little whiffy, so. What? I think that's probably it. I think they explain a lot of things that, maybe if you watch it 5 or 6 times with the closed captioning on, and if you got really invested in the character, and if you did a whole bunch of research, maybe you would eventually watch this movie and say, oh yeah, this makes a whole lot of sense. I wonder if it was, you know, read the book, probably. Maybe reading the book would make all of this make sense. But how often, that's true in so many films today too, right? How often do we watch a movie today and people are like, oh, I really liked it, but half the stuff didn't make any sense? Well, you didn't read Harry Potter before you watched it. Of course it didn't make any sense. For the people that read it, we understand all of it. For the people that just watched it, no, you guys are like, it was an okay movie, but it wasn't that great, right? So it's probably, did I just rant? I think I just ranted. Is my rant showing?
Ranted a little bit.
I'm so
but
sorry.
I think you're right. I think you're right. This story would be much better in a very large novel.
Which is probably why it was popular enough to be made into a movie.
Yes. Of course, I don't know how someone finishes a novel and it's immediately optioned for a film. there must have been someone knew somebody, and you know, Clark was like, "Hey, let me tell you about this novel I'm writing." I don't know.
You wonder how. You wonder if there was like a kind of a studio promo thing going on at the time, right? I wonder if that's kind of the case where sometimes there were movies that, or there were books coming out that were by a famous author. I don't know if this was by a famous author or not. You said the author's name, but I didn't recognize it.
Donald Henderson Clark.
Yeah, not a name I recognize at all. Yeah, maybe that was one of the things. Maybe he was already working in film doing screenplays, and so who knows. He shares my birthday. That's, you know what, that's it. That's, he's cool. Maybe that's what it was, but that is interesting. I didn't realize it was optioned immediately after it was published.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think we've solved the mystery. This movie, it would be better as a book. But let's do real quickly talk about the actors, because we mentioned them, but we didn't talk about how they do.
No, and thank you for bringing it back to that, because that is something that I did want to bring up, is, and that was one of the things that annoyed me from this in this film a little bit, is there are scenes where you think, wow, I can see why people liked Helen Twelvetree. She's really good in this scene, and the scene's over. They don't have enough to do. You could see a film where it's based on, well, in this movie, everyone loves Millie. Mm-hmm. She's just liked by everybody when she's in her little small hometown and she goes driving by. All the kids at the malt shop are like, oh, there goes Millie.
I finally realized what that sounded like. It was Seven Brides for Seven Brothers. It's Millie. Hey, it's Millie. I was like, what? Yeah. I've seen this movie before. No, I've seen Seven Brides for Seven Brothers. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, so everyone is enamored with Millie. All these out-of-town people staying at this hotel go to the counter, and they're trying to pick her up, and she's all... That's a great little scene, that moment when she's really polite, and she's funny, and she's pretty much just giving them the brush off, but doing it in a very fun and friendly way. And you're like, yeah, okay, I can kind of see why men are fixated with her.
And then as soon as they walk away, her facade slips and she's just like, ugh, another one. Oh, here's the next customer. Hi, how are you today? It's I think she's excellent in that scene. I think yes. You're right.
Yeah, it's fantastic. The other actors, I think, we talked a little bit about Joan Blondell as like sort of the comic relief, the ditzy blonde sort of thing or whatever. Mm-hmm. I mean, she definitely has her... That's what she does, pretty mm-hmm. much, and she does it really well.
I think Lillian Tashman as Helen does a great job, too. You get that she is the, like, the, quote, smart one, right?
Yeah,
she's the smart one. And I think she's really good at being that kind of, I don't not caustic, but disenchanted. Like, she's mm-hmm. in it for what she can get. I like her personality. I think she does a great job portraying that character.
Yeah. It's another film, and we've run into this many times where we've talked and said, this is a really great cast. Mm-hmm. I want to see him in a different movie.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like this movie is the same way. I think mm-hmm. the actors all do remarkably well with what they're given, but they're just not terribly enjoyable in this story.
I think it's not an enjoyable story. This is a story about a woman who is deeply disappointed through life. And it's hard to, you know, we already know I like happy endings, and it's hard to sit through a movie where a person is consistently disappointed, consistently let down, and it gets frustrating after a while, and you keep waiting for, oh my gosh, it's like Saw. You keep waiting for something good to happen, and nothing good happens.
I was thinking of leaving Las Vegas.
I was going to make a joke about getting to Las Vegas and feeling that way, but... I can't say that. We might have Las Vegas listeners. But no, that's exactly what it is. I think this is a movie that the story is not an enjoyable story to watch. And so no matter how well any of the characters do, you're going to walk away from this movie disappointed. Because the best thing you can say about it is, well, at least she didn't hang.
Right. Yeah.
That's a horrible reference for a movie. Like, if that's the best thing that you can say about a movie, that's not great. And it's not that it's a poorly made movie. It's not that it's necessarily poorly directed. I think you're right. It probably had a very low budget. But there's not, it's not that it is technically poor. It's that the story is such a downer, and that you're consistently, even though Millie is kind of upbeat through most of it, even when she's crying on her friend's shoulder on Christmas night, refusing to see any men, you know, she still is a little plucky. But then you get that 8 years later time card, and all of a sudden it's this beaten down, downtrodden, sad, loose woman. And really? Is that where we're going to end it? And the best thing you can say is, well, she saved her daughter's virginity. Mm-hmm. Really?
Yeah. Do you think, was it an attempt at a morality play?
Well, so the tagline on it, I just happened to see it. The tagline is, man pays a price, woman pays a penalty. Ooh, and okay. It says it's a romance. Guys, this is not a romance.
No.
It's just not. It's a drama, and it's, you have to be in the mood for a drama to watch a drama, right? So I think what they were trying to do with this movie is they're trying to say, hey, men can play around and they get one result. Women play around and they get another result. We already know that. Even in 1931, we already knew that.
Yeah, that's where I'm saying it. Was this sort of a cautionary tale for any women that might be thinking of not getting married and just living lives?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Look what's going to happen to you.
Is my feminism showing? Excuse me. Let me try and reel that back in for a second here. Yeah, I think it's interesting. They portray her too positively for me to feel like it's a strict morality tale. They definitely show her as being intelligent, clever, fun, beautiful, and you probably could make the argument that they're trying to show that even if you have everything going for you, if you're not faithful in the end, you'll be miserable. But her unhappiness doesn't stem from her lack of faithfulness. It stems from her husband's lack of faithfulness. Mm-hmm. So I don't think you can argue that it's a strict morality tale. I think that I think it would be interesting to find out why the author wrote the book. What he was trying to say. Of course, we're not going to be able to find that out unless we can find some interviews from him. You know, but writers don't always have a deep meaning behind their books. Sometimes they just want to write a story. So yeah. In this case, you know, we get a very involved story, but I don't know that there's really a message behind it, because even at the end, the message isn't don't be a loose woman because you'll hang. That's not what it is.
Yeah. All right. Well, should we put up some ratings on this one?
Yeah, I think it's time.
Yeah, absolutely. I appreciate that this film kind of went places. It is very pre-code in many aspects.
Mm-hmm.
What they did with that, questionable at best as far as it just... To portray a woman in early on, at least in this film, as, you know, look, you said it too. I've been married. I don't want to do that anymore. I'm happy with having a relationship and we can be together. That's pretty strong and powerful. That's mm-hmm. like, that's empowering right there.
Yeah.
But I feel like she's penalized for it. The character mm-hmm. is. They go places that I think are really interesting. But in the end, I don't feel we go anywhere mm-hmm. with it. I loved many of the cast members, but like I said, it makes you want to watch them in a better film.
Yeah.
This one, while it's not horrible, it's not good at all.
I expected you to say it's not great. I said it's not good.
Truly, out of many of the films we've watched recently, this is probably the one I've enjoyed the least. I can only give this one a 2. You could easily skip this film and really not be missing anything.
Okay.
So yeah, just a 2 for me.
Okay, fair enough. It's so funny. I think this is such a strange movie.
It is.
So I'm going to lead off with my rating. I'm going to give it a 3.
Okay.
Because I think that the character of Millie, I think though she's treated very badly by the script, I think I love seeing this aspect of her and her two friends in this movie. Every guy in this behaves like a jerk. Mm. Every man, it's almost like the women. It's almost like The Opposite Sex, which is the remake of The Women, where the men are just this, they're almost incidental. They're almost not important to the plot, except that in this case, they're completely important to the plot because they keep wrecking her life, right? Or they keep doing things that can enable her to wreck her own life. But I like how she's portrayed. I think having this mentality is so interesting for, like, she keeps saying independence, right? For the independence of women, for that to show up in 1931, I think is important and interesting. The cast, gosh, there are so many actors in this that really, I, like you said, I'd love to see them in another part. I've seen them in other parts and they've been very entertaining. And even in these kind of stinker parts, again, I think all of the women really stand out as being interesting, with the exception of Connie, who, I mean, she's 16, right? And what is it that he says in The Lady Eve? A girl of 15 is practically an idiot anyway. So she's 16, but close enough, right? And so I think it's important. From that standpoint, I think it's interesting. I think I like that it is character driven. I like that there's not some huge deus ex machina that walks in and resolves everything at the end. I'm not totally happy with the ending, but I think that Helen Twelvetree's acting in this, I think she could teach a masterclass. I think even though this is 1931 and there's still an amount of pantomime. There's still a level of pantomime to some of the acting in this, you know, carrying over from the silent era. I think, and of course her makeup is straight up silent era makeup for like the first little while. despite that, I think that the character is interesting enough that it's worth a watch, if, especially under certain circumstances, if you're looking for early hints at feminism, or I can't think of the right word for it, but if you're looking for that kind of thing, I think this is an interesting watch. I think it's very, very interesting that you have three fairly strong, and actually if you want to include Mrs. Maitland, Jack's mother, as also being a strong character in this, I think there are three women in this that are all pretty interesting and strong characters. Not under the modern definition necessarily. So yeah, I want to give it 3. I think that there's enough decent in it that it's worth a watch if you're looking for some specific things. Yeah, is this the movie that I'm like, hey, if you're going to watch a 1931 movie, this is the one to watch? No, definitely not. But I think that if you're looking at some big actor names of this era, this is a really good one to go into. I would love to see Joan Blondell in something else. I think she's phenomenally pretty. She's just kind of mind-blowingly pretty.
Yeah, very much.
Yeah.
No, it does make me want to try to find something with her. Like I said, her name sounded familiar, and I, as far as I can tell, we haven't covered any films that she's been in.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would like to see if she ever headlined a film. And what that's like and what she's like in that movie.
Yeah, me as well. So that might be something worth watching out for. But yeah, so I'm going to give it 3 stars. That gives us an average of 2.5 Othels. I don't think that's an unfair rating across the board for this, but I'm really interested to know what other people think. Anybody else that's watched this, if they're just like, oh, you know, Helen Twelvetree is a powerhouse. She's incredible. Like, I would not argue with that statement. I think she's a phenomenal actor in this movie. Through this whole movie, she's so great. We've seen other things we liked her in more, or that we liked more with her in them. So again, probably not the movie to watch with Helen Twelvetrees, but she is in this movie. I think she shows a remarkable range. And so just for that reason alone, it's probably worth a watch if you like her.
I liked the characters. I just didn't like the story. That's really what it boils down to for me.
I 100% agree. I would love to see all of these characters, all of these actors, all these characters in a different story.
Well, okay, that is going to do it for Millie. If you go ahead and watch the film, or if you have seen the film, please let us know what you think of it and which side did you fall in. Did you enjoy the characters and not the story? Did you think the story's okay? I'd really like to get your opinion on the film. Go ahead and write to us at orphanedentertainment@gmail.com or come and leave a comment in any of the social media sites. Always a fun time discussing it with you, Lydia. You know, even when the film one of these weird ones where you're kind of wondering what it is that we watched.
Yeah. Well, and if, you know, we could make a real effort to only watch happy movies. And I think we don't do that. I think we try really hard to find a nice breadth of different types of film and different types of storylines. And that's hopefully what makes listening to this fun. You never really know what you're going to get this month. And hopefully next month will be better.
Yes, absolutely. But that's going to do it for this one. I want to thank everyone for listening. We will talk to you in another month. Until then, bye, everybody.
Bye.